Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.
It's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance neath the cover of October skies.
What's up, everybody? Welcome aboard to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horwitz is my guy, my friend, one of my partners, Keith Bliss from Katonin Company, and full of a whole bunch of new surprises. But Keith, what's up and what's going on in this crazy market?
Hey, Bubba, it's been too long since we've had a nice conversation like this. What's going on in these crazy markets is they continue to get crazier. They continue to get more manipulated. They continue to travel down a path of bubbles being created all over the place, and massive intervention from central banks and other supposed learned central planners around the globe. Nothing has changed since we last spoke. It's only gotten worse.
And it figures to continue to get worse, does it not? I mean, if they're going to continue to try to hide from the trouble that's out there, then the problems only can figure to multiply. What do you think?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's almost to the point where they missed the opportunity to get out of this crazy monetary policy that globally started to be installed across all the markets in 2008. They missed the window of opportunity to do it in a more seamless fashion than they're trying to do it now. Now it's to the point where they've got to tinker around the edges and continue to do things, and it just makes it worse and worse and worse. And I think you're seeing, you know, when we talk about some of the events that you're seeing out there in the marketplace right now that are going to occur, two big ones that may or may not occur, I should say. One is the vote from the United Kingdom about their leaving the EU, and also somebody like Donald Trump actually almost probably maybe elected president of the United States. These are things that occur when people are sick and tired of massive intervention, massive regulation, governments trying to tell everybody what to do. And you see that in the markets every day. And again, I see no end in sight, because the central banks are now in a position, and the governments are allowing them to be in a position, where they have to keep imposing and doing crazy things they think they do. Where I'm of the opinion, I think you are too, where they should just, you know, kind of rip the Band-Aid off. Let the chips fall where they may. There'll be some pain involved, but they need to just get out of the way once and for all.
Well, I mean, I think you're one of the smartest guys I know when it comes to, you know, understanding the workings of the market. And it's not just, they just don't go up, they just don't go down. There's a lot of underlying factors that go on. And I think that they really blew their opportunity, which you've already said. But now they're only compounding it, and the only way to really get out is to let free markets come back in, because we don't really have free markets anymore. I mean, we've got some price discovery, but the markets are kind of pegged, you know, almost like the Chinese currency is pegged to certain movement, and then once it gets there, one of these Fed jokers comes out and says something to create the opposite effect to stem the tide in the market. And until we get back to a true free market society, I think this is going to be a much bigger problem. And I think the more it mounts, the bigger the problem is going to be when it's all done. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree 100%. And that's what I was trying to convey, probably not all too well, is that the more involvement that you layer on top of the existing involvement, the worse the problem gets. You and I are saying the same thing. And what you're also pointing out is, I know you like when I throw big words at you, so I'm going to hit you with one right now. The market has become Pavlovian in its response. You know,
Well, Pavlov's dogs, I know that one.
Where any Fed official comes out and says something that the market deems favorable or unfavorable, it reacts immediately. So there's gone are the days of truly trying to evaluate and value the cash equity market based upon the discount and future cash flows of a company, which is the fundamental reason why you buy or sell a stock, based upon whatever model you're building and what tells you how much a company is going to earn going forward, and therefore what the value of that company will be going forward. We don't even need to do that anymore. We have it for a long time. We were told that we were going to get back to that many times, and you talk about, I could pinpoint them missing the window of opportunity, probably going all the way back to 2014, when they should have started getting out of the way, normalizing, let the pain happen, but get us back to a more normal interest rate environment, and they didn't do it. So now, what I've been saying a lot lately, talking about problems that are going to compound themselves, is that what I've been saying a lot lately is that if you look historically from a broad macro perspective, historically, boom cycles in the United States last about 7 years. We are beyond that historical average right now. And I theorize that's one of the main reasons that the Fed has been so insistent in jawboning the market and telling everybody that they need to get 3 interest rate increases this year. And I think it's because they want to have a little dry powder at the end of this year in case they need to start easing again. You know, if the economy does start to turn more negative, we're already starting to see signs of that. The macro data, whether you believe it or not, is not important, but the macro data that we get and we trade off of every day has started to become mediocre at best. And some cracks in the facade are starting to show up. So they're in a real bind, in my opinion. If we get to the end of 2016 and things are not looking good economically, they're not going to have a Fed funds rate at a level which will allow them to slash interest rates or bring them down a quarter point. And I think we'll probably end up going into a QE4 as a result.
Well, actually, I've been calling for the QE4 for quite a while, and I think that that's a very viable prospect. I think, again, the biggest issues we have here is a market that is not responsive to what normally should be responsive to, and we continue to let, you know, the leaders tell us that, well, the jobs are better. Well, the jobs are really not better. We're actually losing jobs. Yes, maybe the 4.7 jobs rate is better, but that's not really better because we're making less money as a whole than we were making before. So you have a lot less spending power, which will not drive retail sales, will not drive the important things. So really, at the end of the day, you're just destroying the middle class. That's what I say. What do you say?
That is one of the reasons that you're destroying the middle class, and you're also destroying. And here's the real problem with their policies of the last few years. I'll tell you the basic transmission mechanism of why the Fed would lower interest rates is the way it's supposed to happen is they lower interest rates, therefore putting more liquidity into the system, into the banking system. The banks are what we've done in 200 years before the last 10 years. The banks would turn around and lend that money out and create what we call demand deposits for companies and other institutions to invest in capital, to invest in labor, to create what we call the velocity of money inside of the economy. It means every time a dollar turns over, you want to increase the velocity of money so that the liquidity moves around the system, creates jobs, creates wealth, creates income. That's not happened because you also had, in the last 8 years, you had this tsunami of regulation that came over all industries. You had a tsunami of financial regulation, which really hampered non-bank financial institutions as well as banks. And you had an environment where commerce came to a screeching halt. So the Fed is pumping all this liquidity into the market. They're expecting the banks to lend it out. The problem is nobody's coming to the bank window to borrow it because they're so nervous and uncertain about what the future is going to be, and they're unwilling to invest in capital, equipment, and labor. So you had that breakdown, and that's one of the reasons why the economy has really stalled out here in the United States. There's lots of other reasons, but that's the primary reason. So now you've got to hold
that thought, because I want to pick this up, because you're on to something here, and I've got a little bit of a rebut, but it's really on the same vein of what you're talking about. This is the Bubba Show. Make sure that you check out our friends at Thinkorswim, built by traders for traders. As you know, every day they've got swim lessons for you. They really try to help educate you. It is one of the platforms that I use. So make sure you check out Thinkorswim. And in the meantime, when you miss an episode and you got a guy like Keith Bliss, how could you ever want to miss that? You go to libertytalk.fm and be one of the now 225,000 people that are downloading the show every month. And if you're not downloading, I'm coming out to get you. We got to get you on there. We got to get to 300,000. This is the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz. We'll be back right after the break with more from my guy Keith Bliss from Katona & Company. The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Bubba Show. Alma Horwitz is my guy, Keith Bliss, Catone & Company Vice President, but more importantly, a star on Fox, wears a lot of nice ties. He's a star on CNBC. He's a star everywhere. He's just a very well-rounded guy, so I couldn't finish your thought, my man.
Well, what I was saying, getting long-winded and doing a top-level money and banking lesson here. So I was talking about how the transmission mechanism of when the Fed lowers interest rates and puts liquidity into the system, how the transmission mechanism of building, of growing the economy and building wealth has broken down. And we've seen it for years and years. And I've always marveled that the Fed and other central banks will continue to push on that string, thinking that if they just continue to pump more liquidity into the market, it'll solve the problem, and we'll get back to at least 3%, 3.5% GDP growth, you know, and unemployment down. Full employment in this country, by the way, most people don't know, is around 4.5%. So we're almost there, and we've still got mediocre growth, and we've still got incomes lower than they were in 2007. So if something's not working and you've tried it long enough, I'm not a believer in saying something hasn't worked for 6 months, let's try something else. But if something's not worked for 9 years, 9 to 10 years, you really need to think of a different strategy. But what we've seen is that now more central banks around the world have actually started to take the Fed's lead, and they've done their own extraordinary monetary policies. For example, the European Central Bank now buying investment-grade corporate bonds. And I just find this fascinating as well as troubling. If I was an investment-grade corporation in Europe, I would have a mammoth bond offering on the shelf ready to go, and then I would take that money that I get from the bond offering that I sold to the ECB, and I would go buy all my stock back. And that would then increase, you know, obviously the value of the stock by taking float out of it. And we saw the same thing happen in the United States. So my point is this, is that all this extraordinary monetary policy has not helped the middle class. It certainly hasn't helped the older generation who's trying to save, because how can you earn anything in your savings at a 0% interest rate? And the only people it's helped are the corporations and the ultra wealthy. They're the only ones that have benefited from this monetary policy. And unless they unwind it quickly with something different that actually allows companies to bring capital back into the country, like change the corporate tax rate, invest that capital in plant and equipment and labor, like giving them tax incentives to do that, we're gonna continue to stall out here, and we're gonna be stuck in a zero or negative interest rate world for the foreseeable future.
So, you know, I have one thing with you. So you talked about the banking and the big companies being able to borrow and not wanting to put capital. But I'm from the school that I think that the little guys can't borrow because the banks won't give them the money, and I wouldn't give it to them either based on the current structure, because why would I loan it to somebody at let's say 3.5 when I can get 2.5 or 2.75 with the full faith and credit? So why? But I think that the only way that you can get out of this is by bringing back entrepreneurship, which we've really almost eliminated in this country. And until we get that back, that's what creates real jobs. That's what creates paying jobs. And that's what could possibly bring back some manufacturing and some of those guys back into this country and back to work. What do you think?
I agree 100%. And you're never going to get there. And let's be totally candid here. This administration that we've been living under for the last 7.5 years is really, in my mind, some may think this is an unfair statement, others will agree with me completely, this administration has done nothing but strangle the entrepreneurship in this country for the last 7.5 years. The imposition of different regulations, the imposition of different taxes on different things, the inability for, even if it's a small business and they want to do offshore activities, the inability for them to repatriate the cash that they earn offshore, it's not a conducive environment. And in fact, if you look at some of the global studies that look at the friendliest business environments in the world, the United States used to always traditionally be at the top. That's why everybody wanted to come here. We had an educated labor force. We had a free market. We had a tax structure which was not the cheapest, but was very fair. We had low regulatory environment. All of that has gone away. And if you look at any of the studies that talk about the best business climates around the world, countries, the U.S. is now down into the second or third tier on that. That has to change. And until that changes, as well as some of the other things that would benefit the larger corporations who still, you know, employ thousands and thousands of people here. You're not going to get any kind of growth. I marvel at the people who set these regulations and think that they're doing, or maybe they know that they're not doing the best benefit for us, but I marvel that they can't look at the situation and see the shifting demographics in this country, how we're losing workers because they're retiring, they're getting older, people are not having as many children, so we don't have as many workers coming in the back door. And it's just not going to work longer term. Therefore, you've got to enact some policies to attract business, attract investment, bring back some of those high-paying industries that we you know, capitulated on and let them go overseas. Until that happens, we're going to be running sideways for a long time.
Yeah, and I think I look at the administration. I don't like Obama. I don't make any bones about it, but I don't care. I mean, it's not. Look, he's a president. He's a guy, and he should be doing a job to take care of the country. But I really am upset. For example, the way they ended the coal industry. Now, I've been on this for the last few days, and I go, look, I had no problem. You want to have green? You're worried about global warming? No problem. But don't just shut down an industry in 6 months. Say, hey, we're going to shut you down in 5 or 6 years. You guys need to go out and get reeducated. You need to do things to prepare for the inevitable. But in the meantime, for the next 5 or 6 years, you can work this job. The stockholders can be okay. And everybody has a chance to move out, and they have a chance to move into something new. Because we've seen this happen in big industry before, but they've always given them a chance. In big tobacco, they gave a chance to move into other industries. In big oil, you know they're giving them opportunities before they shut them down. So why in the coal industry did this basically shut them down and kill that economy and take all those workers out of the system?
And when you, and more to the point, when you think about of all the industries shut down, the workers within that industry are probably some of the poorest that we have in this country. So you run them out of business immediately. They don't even have savings to fall back on. It's, you know, I don't want to. We work in the industry, and by and large, most people who work in our industry, not everybody, have some sort of savings or at least access to capital or credit which they can fall back on if, let's say, the financial industry were to be shut down like the coal industry was. That's not the case with the workers in Ohio, West Virginia, and Kentucky, by and large. Not everybody, but by and large, that's not the case. And you know, the arrogance of the administration to just say, we know better than you, coal is bad for you, you're out of business, and good luck, find your own way out of it, is deplorable. It's absolutely deplorable. Moreover, you know, thank goodness this administration is almost out of office, because what's the next industry they do that to? They've absolutely tried to neuter the financial industry in many ways. And it seems like the only industries that they don't touch or they try to promote are industries that have big unions involved. And again, that's probably going to be a comment that a lot of people don't like, but that's a fact. All you have to do is just look at their actions. They speak louder than their words.
Well, I have said on this program many times, when unions were first developed, they were terrific. They were needed to defend the employee or the worker, but now they've become way too big, and now you're seeing this happen in a lot of the pension funds. I mean, I think it's Central TransUnion. They're now their payout is, for every dollar they take in, they got to pay out $3.74. That's not a good business model, and of course we know that it's got to bust out eventually. And those are a lot of the problems that I'm seeing as a, you know, just an everyday average kind of guy. To me, It's a much bigger problem that they've created, and we just basically destroy things for really the lobbyists. Because if you look at it, what's the difference between big oil and coal? They're both dirty, they're both filthy, and they both need to go eventually, but you have to let things happen more naturally and kind of warn people that this is what we're going to go to instead of just shutting down the doors. And that's one of the problems with such a big government, which we're operating right now. So when we come back from the break, Keith, I want to talk a little bit about investment banking. I mean, you kind of explained, because it's not a complex thing, but the average guy really doesn't understand how it all works. And I know you're getting involved in some of this, and I want to kind of learn and have you educate us a little bit about the investment banking world. This is The Bubba Show. I am with Keith Bliss, Catone & Company Vice President, but also you catch him all the time on on Fox. And again, whenever you watch him, no matter what's going on in the market, he always has the same look on his face because he's basically a numbers guy that gets it. In the meantime, this is the Bubba Show. If you miss an episode, LibertyTalk.fm gets you a download every day. We're going to stop by here for a break. We'll be back with more from
I know where I come from. How about you?
Trust. For nearly four decades, that is the reputation Roberts & Roberts Brokerage has forged with their customers. Now, with their full e-commerce website, rrbi.co, it's easier than ever to buy or sell precious metals via Bitcoin or major credit card. Visit them online at rrbi.co or call 800-874-9760 to speak with an experienced professional today. Roberts & Roberts, when you're serious about precious metals.
What's up, everybody? Bubba here. It's finally here, the long-awaited Bubba Report, bringing you news from all the trading floors across the globe. We've got Scott Cialady, the cow guy, as seen on CNBC, Fox, and Bloomberg. We've got Keith Bliss, CNBC, Fox, and a floor trader at the New York Stock Exchange. We've got the Badger, who writes the hot topics in the political news. We got myself putting together my own unique indexes that will help you give you a better idea of what's going on in the market. All you need to do to get a hold of the Bubba Report is go to thebubbashow.org and sign up for the newsletter, or you can email me direct at bubba@thebubbashow.org. We want you to have this report because we've got over 150 years of experience talking about markets, getting ready for the trading, and puts you in the best position to have successful. So email me at bubba@thebubbashow.org to get a copy of your report, or go right to the website, thebubbashow.org. Make sure you get it. It's a must-have for every investor and trader. The Bubba Report.
Bubba Horowitz with my friend, my man, my partner. You're right. You got a view from the floor. You got to check him out. Keith Bliss, Katona Company Vice President, Fox, Yahoo, BNN, CNBC, everywhere. They always want Keith because he is, again, very calm no matter what's going on in the market. And so, Keith, I know you're venturing into and have always been somewhat involved in the bank investment banking business, but it's not a complicated business. But for the average guy, it is complicated because there's a lot of working parts that go into this business. Tell us what it's about, and then tell us what you're doing.
Sure. Well, thanks for the opportunity. Yeah, it's a new business that that we're starting here at Katona & Company. It's not a new business to Wall Street at all. And in fact, if you go back to the history of finance, you know, investment banking is, and merchant banking, its sister type of activity, is older than stock trading, in fact. So investment banking is pretty simple to understand. There's somebody who needs capital to run their business, and then what an investment banker does in the most simplest transaction is it works with that person or company or entity that needs capital for whatever they're doing. Maybe they want to build a plant, maybe they want to hire more staff, maybe they want to make investments, maybe they want to take over another company and they need capital to do that. And so the investment banker works with that company, and then they turn around and they find the capital suppliers. So that's the very simplistic transaction. But an investment banker, so that's their basic function. But an investment banker also advises companies that are looking for capital, helps them structure how that proposal will go to the market, the people that supply the capital, and helps them get that transaction completed. So investment bankers get involved in structuring bond offerings. The one that most everybody knows is investment bankers are involved in initial public offerings of stock when a company goes public. And it's their expertise and their access to sources of liquidity and capital that provide that needed connection on the transaction. And of course, the reason companies need access to capital is what we were talking about earlier in the show, is that promotes growth in the economy. That promotes the formation of job creation. That promotes companies going out and investing in their own activities, and therefore having downstream effects inside of an economy that benefits all kinds of people. So here's a quick example for you, and then I'll talk more about specific activities that we're doing. You take a look at something like the Keystone Pipeline, Keystone XL Pipeline. So the company that was going to build that pipeline was not going to use all of their cash to do it. They were going to use a combination of, I believe they're going to do a debt offering, a bond offering. They were going to do some bank financing. And I think they were also talking about doing a secondary offering of stock, which would allow more equity ownership inside of Transcontinental, the company that was building the pipeline. So those were three ways that they had various investment bankers out there structuring transactions and then going to different liquidity sources, whether it was the public, whether it was pension funds, whether it was high net worth investors, sovereign wealth funds, and a sovereign wealth fund is basically the wealth entity for a country, and they would then sell that deal. However, let's say they were looking to raise $1 million to do an activity, they would go to an investor and say, "Would like to have you give them $1 million. Here's the deal," and whatever the transaction structure that again is an initial public offering, a convertible bond offering, a preferred share offering, you name it. There's all types of ways that you can put those transactions together, and then the company takes it and uses those proceeds to do various activities. So what we're doing is we're doing some of that. We have my main thrust, what I'm doing here, is providing the access to the capital. So we have relationships with well over 1,000 what's called family office structures, which are basically investment houses that are managing the wealth of families who, all the way from the very wealthy of the world down to somebody who ran a manufacturing business and sold it and now has a few million dollars in his pocket, and they manage their business, manage the wealth of that family in a certain way. So we have contacts and relationships with well over 1,000 family offices, sovereign wealth funds, pension funds, high net worth investors all over the world. And we also then have relationships with various boutique investment banks on the other side that have companies that are looking for capital and financing, have financing requirements. And so we get involved in that. And we do some structuring of the deals. We work with the investment bankers who have better expertise a lot of times to structure the transactions. That's one thing that we do. But another thing that we do, which is very exciting, is most everybody that listens to your radio show or watches any kind of financial television has heard about the so-called unicorns. And these are late-stage growth technology companies that have not yet gone public that are valued over $1 billion. And it's the companies that you hear about. You may have used Uber, Airbnb. Kids have all used Snapchat. That's how they communicate with one another. Those companies are privately owned still, but they actually have shares of stock underneath them. And the only way you can get access to ownership of the company is you need to go through a process that allows you to buy the private shares of stock from a current owner. We are also involved in those activities pretty heavily across a broad spectrum of companies that have been created out of Silicon Valley, Asia, Europe, some Latin American entities. So we broker those transactions. So if a large pension fund wants to get an equity ownership in Snapchat, or a large Indian company, by the way, that we're working on right now, if they want to get a large equity ownership in one of those, they would come to us and we would find people who are willing to sell their shares of stock inside of those companies. That's the basic transaction. And obviously it can get much more complex than that. It's a long negotiation process, but it's an interesting arena because and I think it's going to be still continuing to be a growth area, because more and more companies, as they are able to attract, as they have good businesses, and as they're able to attract capital to continue to manage their businesses, there's really no reason for them to go public. But yet, they will continue to grow. They will continue to throw off cash that will benefit the shareholders, and there will continue to be demand for people to get in there. The other thing about some of these companies will go public, and that's the other play. So, for example, Snapchat just did another round of financing, round of fundraising that they did, which valued Snapchat at $22 billion. Now, I know that's probably eye-popping to a lot of people. All they know is Snapchat is on the phone. Their kids use it to communicate with one another, make funny videos, you know, they have funny conversations with one another. But once you have a device, a product like Snapchat, which is available on every phone and hundreds of thousands, millions of people use it on a daily basis, then you can start driving other products into it. You can now, for example, read your Wall Street Journal through Snapchat if you want, and that's how they generate the revenue. That's how the value is created inside these companies, and that's why people demand ownership in those companies. So we're very heavily involved in that, and we're growing the business right now.
Okay, so in that business, as you move forward and you do things, I'm a big anti-compliance guy. I think that regulations and things are just really ridiculous right now, and they're really preventing deals like this. Does it have a big play in this field as well?
There are certain things that you have to do because we do, most often the transactions are done under a regulatory structure called a private placement memorandum. So you have to be licensed to the broker-dealer that you do the transaction through has to be licensed by the SEC to do private placements, which is really just getting the approval on it. And there are certain structures that need to be in place. Sometimes you get compliance restrictions placed on you by the companies themselves. They don't allow certain transfers of ownership to certain places. Some companies don't allow transfers of ownership at all, for example. But it's certainly not like the public market, where you have, you know, just reams of regulations that you have to deal with when you're a publicly traded company. But the other thing is to bear in mind is a lot of the transactions that we do are not for. There are firms that do this for smaller investors or retail investors. The transactions that we do are typically larger in size and dealing with institutional qualified investors who know what they're doing and know what they're getting into. There's a large due diligence period that they undertake. But again, back to your initial question, the compliance restrictions on it are much less than you would find in the public arena.
Right, because I just feel that, you know, we've over-regulated everything. It's become to a fact, and I don't know what the reasoning is for it, because basically the regulators, they just pick on the low-hanging fruit most of the time. They're more going after the easy mark. You know, they don't go after the J.P. Morgan or the Goldman Sachs because they're not going to win. They're going to end up in a battle. So I find that to be a bigger problem, and I'm concerned about over-regulating everything, because we've already seen a dramatic slowdown in the markets. We've seen some slowdown in trading. I know a lot of it's got to do with other parts of it, but of course, the business you're in today, the floor business, is dying quickly. And I want to come back, when we come back to the break, I want to talk about what do you see in the future of the actual floor trading and markets, because there are obviously more algorithms, there's more electronic coming out, there's more automated things coming out. We are with Keith Bliss from Catone & Company, and also now involved in their investment banking division. But again, you catch him on Fox, you catch him on CNBC, catch him on everything, because he is the man and he's got all the answers. Not always right, but he does have an answer for everything. This is the Bubba Show, Top Bubba Horse. Make sure if you miss an episode, go to libertytalk.fm and download. Be one of the 225,000 people that are doing so. This is the Bubba Show, Top Bubba Horse, and we'll be right back after the break. The Bubba Show. Welcome back to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz with my boy, Keith Bliss, Catone & Company, Vice President, Fox, CNBC, Bloomberg, everywhere. He does everything. The man, he does know a lot. I give him a lot of credit, and he's a big writer of View from the Floor on the Bubba Report. Always great, insightful information. So, Keith, I say that the trading floors are just about gone. I think New York will be the last to go out of all of them, because they've really been away from the what we call the open outcry market forever. But I do think the Chicago floors are going to be gone. I don't know if they're going to make it through this year, in my personal opinion. Do you have any thoughts there?
Well, certainly the trend has been that way for years and years, and I think it's picked up in speed over the last couple of years. If you take a look at the volumes, if you take a look at the number of traders that are actually on the floor, both in Chicago and New York, I agree with you. There's a school of thought, though, that that suggests that the New York will never close down because it's an icon, it's a global icon for American commerce and capitalism, certainly much more well-known, no offense intended with the statement, it's much more well-known around the world than the Chicago trading floors, although I find the Chicago trading floors more interesting than the New York where I'm sitting right now. But broadly speaking, yes, that is a trend that we certainly see. Again, not sure the New York Stock Exchange floor will ever close, will ever technically close to the physical traders, but you'll see the human nature of trading and the physical presence of traders continue to be diminished lower and lower as the years go on. And a lot of it has to do with automation, but more of it has to do with the regulatory environment, how it's continued to crimp the ability of traders and firms to actually make enough money to keep people down here. So firms, whether you're a market maker, whether you're an agency broker like Katone & Company is, or even if you're an investment manager, a buy-side firm, a hedge fund, what have you, you've had to employ automation just to keep your costs minimized, because the ability to make money in the trade has been reduced dramatically over the years. As the spread that came in, for example, in cash equities trading, as we went from trading in 1/16 of a dollar, which is 6.25 cents, down to a minimum price variation of 1 cent, that's 5.25 cents that automatically comes out of the spread. Not in every case, but in a lot of cases, in a lot of the stocks you trade, that's a substantial reduction in the amount of money you have the ability to make on that. And then for what we do, agency broking, for buy side, for asset managers, we charge a commission. The commissions on those trades have come down dramatically from in 2001, 2002, we were still charging 5 cents a share. Now we're lucky if we get 0.25 cents a share. So similar to the spreads, the actual commission rates have come down pretty dramatically. And so you add those two things up, no real push inside of the markets to expand the markets, regulatory environment, which is actually looking to reduce the influence of capital markets in many ways in our society and our economy. And it just doesn't add up to an optimal environment for the human-based trader and therefore the floors to stay open.
Right. I mean, they're just creating a reason for them to close. And, of course, you know, I know the Chicago exchanges would love to close because they'd love to run to Indiana and not pay taxes and not do anything. And the floor itself costs them about $20 million a year just to keep open, which it's an expense that the shareholders would love. But what they've really done is destroy more jobs, which is kind of how we started off the conversation today. But when I look around and I see, you know, everybody building these algorithms, and now I don't know if you know this or not, I'm just curious, I guess there's a degree of algorithm you can buy. You can buy the deluxe, which gets you information faster and gets you in faster, and there's a lower model and a lower model. Are you seeing any of that, and does that bother you?
Definitely seeing it. In fact, we market those algorithms, and again, we've been forced to. In any broker who wants to survive has to. What we do is we do what's called white labeling algorithms, and some of those algos that you just described, to our various clients. There's lots of firms out there that have quantitative analysts that build their own computer models and their own computer algorithms for trading in the market. We work with those people, and we go out and sell those algorithms to various firms that want to use them for trading their own account or their client's money or what have you. And again, it's not something that we wanted to do. It's something that we were forced to do just for survival. In a world where you have other firms doing that same activity and continuing to disintermediate you away from the point of sale in a trade and charge lower commissions, you either decide that you're going to get out of the business altogether, or you decide that you're going to try and compete and maintain the business. We believe that at Katone & Company, we have years and years of expertise in floor trading, in algo building, in agency brokering of transactions, where we can develop and deliver a nice intersection of all those capabilities to the client, give them a better trading experience than they would get from other places. Unfortunately, as I walk around the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, I see lots and lots of firms that are not doing that, and I think they're probably going to be out of business shortly as a result, and they're just sitting there waiting for the trading to come back. The trading's not coming back. It's just not coming back the way that they think it's going to be. So you either evolve or you die. And I think that's going to be one of the things that's going to lead to probably the floors shutting down at some point, is you're just not going to have enough people here to really keep them open. I know you're saying the same thing in Chicago.
No, I mean, it's worse in Chicago because you did say it right that New York is New York, after all. I mean, Chicago is still the second city, and the New York Stock Exchange is a landmark, and, of course, they will stay there. Whether they have to just hire a bunch of their own employees just to run the thing, they'll be there because that is a very big thing going on. But now, so we look forward, and we've discussed and gone through all the problems of the world. We know that there's dramatic problems. How do you see it ending, and how do you see us recovering from it?
Man, I think about that a lot, and I typically come up short with a really happy ending underneath all this. We're coming to the convergence of a couple of problems. Number one is, how deeper can we allow our deficits to get? How far and how much are we willing to continue financing the central banks to do these extraordinary monetary activities? At some point, the money just has to run out, unless you want to debase and devalue the currencies that are involved, like the dollar, like the euro, like the yen, into oblivion, which, of course, would then kick off hyperinflation, although that's been the economic theory that we've been trying to live under for some time, and it just hasn't happened. But I guess what I'm saying in sum is I just don't see any of this ending well. I don't think that the central banks and the central planners have the tools to unwind all of this elegantly. And there will be capital markets disruptions. There will be volatility inside of all of the markets, regardless of what you're trading, all the risk-based markets, whether it's cash equities, futures, options, commodity futures, you name it, will be impacted. So, but at some point, it has to happen. We've got to unwind all of this nonsense and get back to a more stable and more logical type of monetary setup and trading inside of the world. And I just hope it happens sooner than later, and I cross my fingers that it won't be too disruptive to the global economy.
So to put words in your mouth, what we really need to get back to is free markets and real price discovery, and let the markets price the assets instead of having some jackass price the assets for us.
Too true. Too true.
I mean, I couldn't let the whole show go without, you know, giving one of my shots to my favorite people in the world, the librarians of the world that simply sit and try to run the economy out of a theory. Keith Bliss, you are awesome. I always love, you know, having a chance to talk with you. I had a great time talking to you in New York. I'm really excited for your new venture that you're bringing on, because you're the right guy to do it. As always, thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure.
This has been my man, Keith Bliss. Check him out. A View from the Floor. He's on Facebook. He writes for Bubba Trading. He's writes for the Bubba Report. I mean, again, you want keen insight, it's Keith Bliss, and you can catch him on Fox and all over the place, because he is always a man with a calm mind. Maybe not inwardly, but outwardly, he's always calm. And that's my guy. He does a great job, and I wish him the best. This is The Bubba Show. If you ever miss an episode, make sure you go to libertytalk.fm and download every single day. In the meantime, that'll do it for today. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Same time, same station. This is The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horse. Thank you so much for being here. We'll see you tomorrow. The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horse.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.